Welcome to the Speech Uncensored podcast, your destination for nourishing and flourishing in the medical speech and language pathology field. Today's episode features Hannah Grassi of the Parkinson's Report, an online resource for SLPs and persons with Parkinson's. Hannah joins me on this episode for part two of her two-hour CEU on evaluation and treatment considerations for working with patients with Parkinson's. I am so pleased to share the audio from the two-hour live ASHA CEU with SpeechTherapyPD.com. If you missed the live event, you can access the video recording plus slideshow with your SpeechTherapyPD.com basic or premium membership. In part two, Hannah presents case studies and walks us through treatment considerations for each patient. Hannah also reviews online tools to share with your patients with Parkinson's and resources for you, the clinician. Be sure to check out the show notes on speechuncensored.com for links to these tools. My name is Leanne Porter. I'm your host, and this is the Speech Uncensored podcast. All right, now let's hear from Hannah. All right, well, hello, everyone. Welcome to our CEU this evening. My name is Leanne Porter. I'm going to be kind of the host and moderator for tonight, and I'm joined with our presenter, Hannah Grassi. So to get started, I thought I'd just share your bio real quick, if that's all right.
Sure.
All right. So Hannah is a clinician in the Virginia region. I guess, well, no, that's a state. So let's go with that. And has practiced in various settings, including special education in schools, skilled nursing facilities, continuing care communities, home health care, and outpatient therapy since 2010. And her primary clinical interest is Parkinson's disease. And she serves as a patient advocate through volunteer work in her community through local and national organizations. Hannah's the founder and blog author of the Parkinson's Report, an online resource and blog for the Parkinson's disease community to gain easily navigable resources on relevant topics to their care. All right, so I'm Leanne, as I mentioned. I host the Speech Uncensored podcast, and that's where I got to kind of begin unpacking Hannah's knowledge on Parkinson's and how we can use that in our practice. Okay, so Hannah, was there anything that you wanted to add to your bio or a little bit more about you and what you're engaged in right now?
Sure, yeah, I'll add just a bit. I recently moved from Washington, D.C. to a slightly more rural area of Virginia, and most recently have been working in an assisted living and independent living setting, so kind of back to some of the roots that I've where I started, and I'm getting to actually start their speech program. They've never had a speech therapist on staff, so it's an interesting time to go back to work, but it has that's what I'm currently doing, and hoping to make a difference in that community.
Okay, now we're going to pick back up with part two of our talk, and Hannah's going to begin with reviewing treatment considerations for dysphagia and Parkinson's.
Okay, so just quickly, treatment of dysphagia and Parkinson's disease. There's a wide variety of issues we've referenced already in dysphagia: tongue pumping, difficulty initiating the swallow, saliva management. There are a variety of studies. I took some data from the Parkinsonism and Related Disorders study in 2010, but it says it pretty much in every study that aspiration pneumonia is the leading cause of death in Parkinson's disease. Now, the percentage of people dying who have Parkinson's who are dying of aspiration pneumonia is highly variable. But it's still the leading cause. So it's kind of, we want to pay extra attention to their swallow because we know that it can be very complicated in the later stages of their disease and could be fatal. But we also want to balance that with it's their life, and we've got to find a way to make their quality of life be at the forefront of our plan of care. So expiratory muscle strength training, EMST, and that is a program I think most of us are familiar with. And that is, there's been quite a few studies, Trochet, Rosenbeck, Hegland, et al., many more, wrote an article in 2010 where they did a study of the use of the EMST device, and they did a 4-week trial, 5 days a week for 20 minutes using the EMST with people with Parkinson's. And based on that study was based on the belief, and I'm quoting here, that reduced safety in the swallow, reduced safety could be due to decreased elevation and excursion of the hyolaryngeal complex. And they reported that based off of that assumption and in the following protocol that I mentioned, that the EMST may in fact be a restorative therapy, not just maintaining, but restorative therapy for dysphagia in people with Parkinson's. And they were measuring that because using the measure of the penetration aspiration scale, and that there were a significant number of people who were no longer experiencing penetration or aspiration. They also were stating that they were looking at people with mild to moderate dysphagia, not severe dysphagia. So it's important to know if you're working with somebody who has a more severe level of dysphagia, EMST actually says there needs to be more research before we say that that's going to make a big difference in somebody with something more than mild or moderate dysphagia. I went ahead and added LSVT loud on here because they do have a variety of studies that have several different measures that took looking at parameters with like video fluoroscopy and all of that. So certainly you can check that out if you want to learn more about how LSVT can improve dysphagia. Modified diets, I'm gonna say just a quick note about. There's a lot to consider when you're modifying somebody's diet, and I personally think that it should be a very last, like very, the very last thing on your list of things that you're doing, especially in patients with Parkinson's disease. I was listening to a podcast that I put later on one of the slides with Dr. Emily Plowman and Dr. Karen Hegland. It was a Down the Hatch podcast, and Dr. Hegland made the point that changing a diet for someone with Parkinson's isn't like changing the diet for somebody who's maybe had a stroke and is coming for rehabilitative therapy. You change that person's diet with the hopes of getting them back as close as you can to their regular diet. But someone with Parkinson's disease, you're putting them on a thickened liquid, they're potentially going to be on that thickened liquid for the rest of their lives. And that's a really significant thing to do to somebody. And it's important to that they're on board and that they're understanding the risks that they're taking, and also that they have a choice. And that's a very important part of modified diets. Sometimes it's important, sometimes it's necessary to modify a diet, but I do think that it should be one of the last measures that we're looking at. I don't know, Leanne, what would you say about that?
I'm like totally on board with you. I feel like what we know now about thickened liquids is that they increase the likelihood of dehydration in a population that's already very fragile health-wise. And if they actually do aspirate some of that thickened liquids, they have worse outcomes than if they were aspirating something like water, like thin water. So I think that's where we have to be very judicious and cautious about how we're recommending this and how this fits in with their life and their overall health. It could be something like maybe thickened liquids with meals and a Fraser water protocol outside of that, that includes really strong oral hygiene. You know, these patients are going to be so varied, and, you know, decision-making in dysphagia is so complex. There's so many levels you're taking into account. You know, if this is still a very active individual, they're very mobile, they might be able to tolerate pretty consistent, I don't know how to quantify that exactly, aspiration of water. Might be able to filter it, like, as opposed to other outcomes. So yeah, it's like a huge minefield to walk into on that. It's just, it's not an easy decision. And also, sorry to get on my little soapbox now, but it's super important that if you go down that path of, you know, recommending the thickened liquid, you've discussed it with the patient, please let all of those decision-making factors be reflected in your documentation for any future SLP who's working with this patient. So they have a really clear idea of everything that you've covered. You've unturned all the stones. It's there in your documentation. And we don't have to wonder, like, do I need to kind of start from scratch? Or, like, no, it's all there in your documentation. Like, yay.
Absolutely. Okay. Please and thank you. Then high repetition. There is, again, I'm going to reference a different podcast that I would highly recommend when you're looking at dysphagia treatment and high repetition and the research behind that. So Swallow Your Pride, episode 13 with Rebecca Levy. Again, I have this on a slide later. She, I think it's called like exercises and more exercises or something like this. And she talks about the research of how many repetitions we actually need to provide in order to learn a new skill or improve a skill, and how they do that with animal models and research. And, you know, it's just some astronomical number, right? Something that we were never taught to do in school. And nobody ever told me you're going to need to do 75 to 100 swallows. Nobody ever taught me that. But she talks a little bit about that. And she also, in her show notes, has this fantastic chart that talks about deficits, cranial nerves affected, the research behind it, and the exercises. And I have referenced that chart so many times when I'm really looking at my folks with Parkinson's or other dysphagia for other reasons. And I would recommend going there to learn more about what we should be doing with dysphagia and repetition. And then, of course, treating the whole person. That's, I think, you need to adjust for things like environmental factor and factors, accessibility to, you know, food and things like this. It's all very important, depending on your setting and looking at the whole person, not just our one area. Mm-hmm. All right, so this is going to take us right into our case studies. I've included case studies. I kind of went back and forth about it, but I included case studies because I think that it helps us get an idea of how we would move forward if it was our caseload. I'm putting it into practice. These are a few questions I ask myself when I'm trying to decide how to move forward with treatment. So what's most important to the patient? How often can they, or, you know, are they willing to come to therapy? Do they have support at home? Are there other hurdles to completing therapy? You know, like a spouse that doesn't believe in it or something like that, you know, because that happens. Do they have idiopathic Parkinson's or maybe a complex medical history? And then is cognition a hurdle? What about depression? What about apathy? And are they going to require more support to meet their goals? So with those in mind, we're going to jump into the case studies. So these three case studies have all been patients of mine. I've changed their names. And I will tell you what I did, but I would love for you, if you want to write in the chat, to say, oh, I think I might try this with that person. Or if you have any other ideas outside of what I did, please put that in the chat box, make it a conversation of what you think you might do with these people. So Mrs. Gutierrez, I'm not gonna read this word for word, but Mrs. Gutierrez, she's 65, referred to me when I was working in home health care. She just had a hospitalization. She had a really bad fall 3 weeks prior, and she had bruising all over her face and was telling me everything she did was just fatiguing, took all of her energy. She has a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease and reported that her biggest concern was just her embarrassment. She was embarrassed every time she talked. She tell her friends could not understand what she was saying, especially on the phone. She's an artist, and she's very involved in the community arts and philanthropic work. It's very important to her. But with a recent decline because of Parkinson's, she had not really been able to participate. She's very eager to begin therapy and told me, I'm assertive, but a little bit forgetful. So I need structure in my therapy to make sure I'm successful. Her husband told me that he can never hear what she's saying, but also admitted that he has hearing loss, okay, which could be an issue. Mrs. Gutierrez reported that she occasionally feels like she might be choking on her pills. And during our assessment, she exhibited a reactive cough at least 3 times immediately when sipping water. Okay, so sister's got a lot going on. So would be curious again, if you want to write something in the chat, what you know, how you would start with your plan of care. A hurdle that I didn't put in here, but that I'll mention to you is after talking with the company I was working for and they talked to her insurance, they would only allow me, I wanted to see her 3 times a week. They only allowed me to go 2x. Okay, so that was a hurdle that she and I had.
No, that's twice a week, but multiple weeks.
Yes.
Not just two visits.
Sorry, yes, twice a week. I wanted to see her three times a week, but they only would cover two times a week. Okay. So she wanted structure. I knew she wanted to work on her vocal volume and her motor speech. Those were important to her. I knew that swallowing was also kind of hanging out in the back. She didn't seem overly concerned, but I could tell that it probably was going to become an issue. And then falls. Falls were a big thing, and I didn't read this part of it, but she had increased falls over the last 3 months. It was a hurdle. Okay. So what we decided to do was...
Wait, let me try.
Yeah, go.
Okay. So because you could only go twice a week, that pretty much rules out LSVT.
Yes.
And of course, it would also rule out LSVT for anyone who's not certified. So they would either have to do Rosenbeck's mind over motor kind of procedure, or if they're certified, do Speak Out. So that's kind of addressing her vocal volume issue the most. But she's also got some swallow issues and a little bit of cognition because she says she needs that structure and she's a little forgetful. So Speak Out has that structure and that companion booklet that might be useful to her. So for her swallowing, I wondered if maybe she might be a candidate for EMST because I think that would also help her with the vocal volume because I like to think it's all very synergistic. And
yeah,
it's like when you're working on this, you're bringing that awareness and they're focused on it and they're exerting that effort and they're building that sensory input back again. As you mentioned, their hypophonia is more related to the sensory than a weakness of the muscles.
Yeah.
So we wouldn't be using EMST necessarily to strengthen muscles because we don't necessarily suspect that they've been weakened, essentially. Did you consider EMST for her at all? Or like, what was your route? What did you do?
So I didn't do EMST, although I think she probably could have benefited from it. Although I didn't put this in here, but she'd have asthma, which was a bit of an issue. I know there are some contraindications for EMST. I didn't mention those earlier. I don't know if asthma is one of them, but I know like acute stroke is untreated hypertension, untreated GERD. Do you know of any of the other contraindications?
Not off the top of my head.
Okay, yeah. So I don't know if asthma was one, but I remember her being a little bit leery of anything that was, even the exercises I was providing, she was like, "Ooh, I've got asthma."
Oh, bless her. Mm-hmm. She was like pumping the brakes for you, Hannah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what I did here was we did decide to go with Speak Out. She loved the program. She liked the colors because she's an artist. She liked how vibrant it was. And she liked the consistency that the exercises that we did in our sessions, that she had the next thing lined up for her after I left. And she could do that on her own. And then because those Speak Out sessions really are only 40 to 45 minutes, I would take the rest of the hour that I spent with her. And we worked quite a bit on effortful swallow and the Mendelsohn maneuver to strengthen her swallow. Then typically we'd say the last 5 to 10 minutes, or if I had that much, depending on kind of how the day was going with her, on scheduling, because her cognition came out in her scheduling. And it took a lot of time to work on scheduling with her. And so we would just sort of touch on that because that executive function was definitely an issue for her. Planning was a definite issue for her. But the cognitive component of Speak Out was also very helpful because she had trouble maintaining her good speech whenever cognitive tasks were introduced.
Ooh.
Okay, that's what I did with her. Next, I was in an outpatient clinic. Mr. Hart came and he came for the works. He came for PT, OT, and speech evaluations. He was just diagnosed a week prior at the age of 57 and was taken entirely by surprise by it. He had no clue he had Parkinson's. Was very, very shocked. He had recently retired from government work. He lives alone, but he spent a lot of time with his girlfriend and his family who were local. He said he was overwhelmed by the diagnosis, but was ready to work. And during the evaluation, he told me that his kids often said they couldn't hear him on the phone, and the girlfriend's always saying, "Speak up, speak up, speak up." He records an occasional festinating gait and a left pinky tremor. He does not require the use of a walking aid and described no other significant hurdles to starting therapy immediately and as frequently as possible. He concluded with, I'll do whatever it takes. Okay, he's a go-getter. So this one is pretty straightforward in the sense that he doesn't have any hurdles to coming to therapy, right? As far as what's most important, he's mentioned that nobody can really hear him. You know, I didn't specifically remark on cognition, but there were no overt cognitive issues. And, you know, he didn't have many other challenges outside of his voice being a little bit too quiet. He didn't even have any many dysarthric qualities to his speech. So it's a brand new diagnosis. He was, I think, a perfect candidate for LSVT Loud. And in an outpatient clinic, even more so, because he could come 4 times a week.
Yeah.
And I think, I'm not trying to suggest that you can only have people with high cognitive skill, you know, and treat them with LSVT Loud, but it is much easier to get good outcomes with somebody who understands what they're working on. And so he was a really good candidate. He did very well. And he graduated and initiated communication with me for follow-up 6 weeks later and had gotten involved in a local group to continue working on his speech. So
awesome. I really appreciate the duality of these two case studies where you're seeing based on setting, and because of setting it being home health, there were insurance limitations that ruled out something like LSVT. And plus you mentioned she had some cognitive issues too that probably wouldn't have made it a good fit, whereas Speak Out fit much better for that patient.
Right.
And then here, he was accessible, I guess, for lack of a better word, right?
Absolutely.
He could come in 4 days a week. He didn't have any challenges understanding what you were asking him to do in those very structured LSVT exercise sessions that also they last an hour as opposed to like 40, 45 minutes. So you're doing voice work for a solid hour. I think you need to have decent stamina for that too.
You really do. You really do. And I will say, LSVT Loud talks about their motto, and their model is very simple, so that people who don't have, who have cognitive deficits aren't having to have all of this new learning. They're just remembering to be loud. But in this case, again, he was a really great candidate and did wonderfully with it and became much more intelligible. And very few people said they had issues, you know, after he'd completed the program. So I've got one more because I wanted to show slightly different angle. Ms. Shipley. She's 83. She's a resident at an assisted living facility. Had a fall 2 months ago, resulting in a hip fracture and hospitalization. So she went from hospital to SNF for 3 weeks and then back to her ALF apartment. She was referred to me because nursing and OT said that she'd had a functional decline. Okay, so nice and vague. Nobody really knows what it is.
I feel like all I get are super vague referrals, and I'm like, okay, I guess I'll figure it out during the eval. Thanks, guys.
What is the diagnosis? Yes. So she, on her face sheet, had a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, dementia, and depression, okay, which, again, could be anything, right? Could present any way. So during the assessment, she reports, I've always been pretty healthy, fortunately. Okay, when you ask her what's going on, she agrees to work with you, but is unable to independently identify any interests or hobbies or activities that she engages in or that's important to her. During conversation, her voicing is adequately loud for the setting. She doesn't actively present with any dysarthria. She sips on apple juice happily the whole time, no issue, no overt issue. And she tells you that her husband passed away about 6 months ago and admits that she's been napping a little bit more than the nurses want her to. The OT tells you that safety's become a much bigger concern, and she can't even walk herself to the therapy gym like she used to. And she used to do it independently with a walker, and she's become a fall risk in her apartment. And then her children report that their father actually died nearly 2 years ago.
Oh.
Okay, plot twist.
Yeah.
Yes, so in this case, I was actually given this patient with the bait that they had Parkinson's disease, because my DOR knows that I like to treat people with Parkinson's disease. Okay. But when
That's
I went in
sneaky.
There, yeah, super sneaky.
I low-key approve of that.
Right, yeah. So when I go in there, though, Miss Shipley's got some other things going on. And maybe she's got Parkinson's, but it's not really showing its head. It's primarily cognition. And it's the kind of cognition that kind of just makes her pleasantly confused, right? So something beyond mild cognitive impairment, maybe PDD, maybe, you know, I'm not diagnosing dementia, right? But when it comes to treating somebody like this, you may go in guns a-blazing, right? You've got your French A ready. but really, it was more appropriate to look strictly at her cognition, and the assessment had to be somewhat informal because she didn't really know what was going on. So that was an important, I wanted to show, right, the variety of what we may be seeing with people with Parkinson's.
I really like that. I really like you highlighting kind of the flexibility of our approach going in, because I have totally fallen victim to like acquiring a hammer and now everything's a nail, and it's like, I will fix you. I will fix everything. And yeah. And then if I see that diagnosis on paper, Parkinson's, then I've already generated so many things in my head, then it must be this and this. And sometimes I miss like taking a step back and seeing like really the problems that she's experiencing, what's impacting her quality of life in this facility is the cognition, like you said. And so, yeah, I really like how you put it, like going with guns blazing. Cause I was like, ooh, I feel seen. Like,
Yeah. So this was a recent one for me. So I thought I'm going to throw her in there because, it was a curveball, and cognition was the thing that needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. Okay. So home maintenance plans. We're getting towards the end here. So home maintenance plans versus ownership habit. Okay. So home maintenance plans, and I put here a caveat, as I was taught, maybe other people have been taught other fabulous ways to create home maintenance plans I don't know about yet. If so, put it in the chat box. So I was in a skilled nursing facility. It was my first healthcare-based job. And what I was taught, we were given these really beautiful one-page like rip-off sheets that were, I think, designed by PT and OT, because it's mostly check boxes of, do this, do that, and a couple of lines where you could write miscellaneous information. The ones that they designed for speech were just not real relevant. So often I'd end up writing in the corners and on the margins and saying, oh, and don't forget this little thing. We were also taught that you are supposed to provide this home maintenance plan sheet one or two sessions prior to discharge so that they would know what to do once they were discharged. And the problem with that, well, there's a lot of problems with that, but the problem with that was that a lot of times I was taking on the ownership of creating a plan that maybe the patient knew about, maybe they were listening, maybe they weren't, that one time that we talked about it, and they go home and they have another little speech folder that gets stacked up with all their other piles in their home, and they forget about it. It's one little sheet of paper. And so the home maintenance plan, when it's implemented like that, I have found to not be effective. Instead, I like the idea of building an ownership habit with our patients and starting from the very beginning of therapy, for that matter, assessment. And when they leave you, say, great, I'm so excited to see you for our first treatment session. When you come, I would like for you to have brainstormed with your loved ones of 10 phrases that they always hear you saying, that you are always saying at home, and I want you to bring those in because we're going to talk about them and we're going to start practicing, right? So we're immediately saying, this is yours, right? To the next bullet point, you're making a choice to commit to this. I'm the coach, and so I'm going to teach you, but you're the athlete, so you've got to do the work, and you've got to do the work even when I'm not looking, right? So So you're just coming to show me what you've been working on that we're practicing together. So we talk a lot about SMART goals, right? So specific, measurable, attainable, reasonable, time-based, but also SMART habits. I tend to use the word habits. I recently switched over a couple years ago using the word habits versus the word goals, because surprisingly, some people have vendettas against goal making. And they see it as, some people will see goals as something that I hope to achieve, but what I want them to do is to build a habit that's a lifestyle, right? I want it to be part of their routine. I don't want it to be something they're going to do. I want it to be something they're actively doing. So SMART habits gives them the idea that they can create a habit in their everyday life that is triggered by their environment. Meaning, example, you're working with someone with dysphagia and they get specific with the habit and they say, every time I sit down for a meal, before I take my first bite, I'm going to do 10 effortful swallows. And that's going to be my habit. It's specific, it's measurable. I either did it or I didn't. There's 10 of them, right? How many did I get done? It's time-based. You know when you're doing it because you're sitting down for a meal. It gives them an opportunity to say, I'm going to build this habit, this therapy habit, into what I'm doing already. Could also be a phone call, right? The son calls every day to talk to his mother, his father with Parkinson's, and they say, every time Johnny calls me, that's going to be my cue. My habit is when Johnny calls, for the duration of our call, I'm going to use my therapeutic talking. Right? So it's a SMART habit.
Hannah.
Yeah.
Just that simple idea of reframing goals into habits is like, like, okay, here's why it's like so mind-blowing for me. Okay, like, let me explain.
Yes.
So, yeah. You know, as we're being trained to become speech and language pathologists, as we're going through grad school, we learn, you know, a big part of this job is learning how to write goals of treatment.
Yes.
And so that's my mind, how I always perceive goals when I say it. But they're coming to us from a non-therapy frame of reference. And outside of our therapy, when we talk about goals, we talk about New Year goals. Like things we hope, like you said, things we hope to achieve. Oftentimes they don't get achieved. Yeah. And so having you frame it like that has really made me see, like, that might be how they're internalizing it. So when I'm like, I'll take a moment every couple of sessions to be like, let's reorient on your goals.
Yep.
Let's make, honestly, it's more for me than for them. Like sometimes I get a little off track and I'm like, get Leanne back on track. This is what we need to be working on. And so, but I agree with you. I am working on changing their habits. And I use that language too. And I talk about how, like, for example, in voice therapy, they've gotten into a habit of using their vocal folds in this manner. We've actually got to break that habit. It's like you've got to break a habit like smoking. And we're going to replace that with a new behavior, a new pattern of actions. And so that's what a goal is. That's what our goal is targeting, is a new habit. So just call it something that they're probably going to like be able to wrap their mind around with a lot more success.
Right. Well, and I think that for me, a habit is something that I do. And because of that, it helps, you know, quote unquote homework, find a way into their everyday activities and becomes a way for them to see progress. And that's ultimately what I think home maintenance plans are designed to do, which is help them maintain their skill and go home and continue to practice. But we need to be doing it from the beginning. And if we can create habits at the beginning, then hopefully they will continue to do them, whether or not we're in their lives. So I think that's just kind of my take on what to do after you've, like when you're sending someone off, instead of giving them a home maintenance plan, hopefully you're saying, great, you just knocked this out of the park. This is your thing. And your thing is that you now talk much more clearly. Well, your thing is that you have a safer swallow because you know how to manage your meals, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a habit that they've been practicing, not one that they're like, oh, I've got to do this on my own now, right?
Yeah, Yeah, that really ties in with what we were talking about way earlier about when we were talking about Rosenbeck's style and how he is all about bringing that patient in heavily at the beginning. Yeah. They're getting that ownership. And so you're seeing that, and that's how you're treating this like home program, right? I don't know that I was really taught a home program kind of a thing. I don't think that ever really came up. It was always encouraged, like, send something home with the patient. Like, you want them to carry over what you've been working on in the home environment. So give them something to do at home. Well, that give them something to do would turn into like a worksheet or something. And then they could bring that in and have me look over. And now suddenly I'm a teacher giving them a grade on a, like a homework assignment. Like, it's a very awkward type of situation. But if you give them a task to do, and then they can kind of like report back to you on it, like, it is, it's much more of that ownership habit. So I love that, beginning with the end in mind.
Yeah.
You're starting with that, always implementing over, bringing them in, having them thinking about what they're doing outside of the session. I love it, Hannah.
Absolutely. Okay, so follow-up timelines and a few things that I consider when I'm thinking about following up with my folks with Parkinson's. I think that the idea of being at a clinic where you regularly see the same people is so wonderful because you get to know them, you get to know their families, the challenges that they face, and if you are in a setting like that, that I think that's really wonderful. If you're not, then the follow-up timelines may look a little bit different, but you should still recommend to your patient or their care partner that they have a follow-up on any area that you're working on. And there's not a magic number. I've put here the LSVT lab or timeline. LSVT Loud and Speak Out both recommend a 3-month checkup. So once you complete their programs at 3 months, you call them or contact them and say, hey, you know, how's it going? Are you still using that loud voice? Are you still speaking with intent? Do you need to come in for a refresher? For most people, they don't come in for another full 16 or 12 sessions. They're coming in just to kind of brush up their skills, try to get involved in a group. And that 3 months, I think, is a good amount of time. There are a few other considerations that I like to put into or red flags that I look for to see, is there a reason why I would want to move that timeline up, or discuss with the care partner things they should be looking for. So the next two bullet points here, I have the Hone and Yar scale and the UPDRS, Unified Parkinson's Disease Rating Scale. I will show you that here on my screen in just a second so you can get an idea of what those look like. The Hone and Yar scale and the UPDRS are used by neurologists, and they, if you're not familiar with them, they are basically rating scales of different areas of deficit, potential deficits in people with Parkinson's disease. Not every neurologist uses them. In my area, the majority of them use it as a reference point. It's kind of like the global deterioration scale. Not everybody fits perfectly in it, but it gives you an idea of where the person may be at that time. Hone and Yar is only motor symptoms, and it's a 5-point scale. Again, I'll show it to you here in just a minute. And then the UPDRS has lots of different areas, and all of our areas are in there: cognition, swallowing, motor speech, voice, along with a lot of the other motor symptoms. So if you have the benefit of knowing where your person is, so your patient is on one of these rating scales, and you see that it has changed, maybe the neurologist has noted it, or maybe you're familiar enough with your kind of subsections that you think, it feels like they've done a backslide or they've had further degeneration, that could be a reason to say, I think we need to up your timeline a little bit. I think I'm going to check in with you in about 6 weeks instead. But both of those can be really helpful to just know what they are. So if you see them in a report, know that they could be really helpful. So I am using this one because they didn't have any specific instructions on who could use this in training. So this is the UPDRS, and I'll just kind of, oh, I have it on the Honan Yar, sorry. They have the Honan Yar on this particular UPDRS as a scale. So you can see there that it's called the modified Honan Yar. It's exact same as Honan Yar. It just has different wording. So unilateral disease, bilateral, mild bilateral, severe. So it's very vague, but it's frequently used. And then the UPDRS is all these other pages. Let me scroll to the top here. So mentation, behavior, mood, ADLs. They talk here for both on and off, depression, salivation, swallowing. Right, so there's so many areas here that, you know, once they get a number, you know, obviously we're going to want to know in our areas, how are they doing? And again, this is not something that we provide. This is something neurologists provide, but it can be helpful to know that this is something that could show you if you see your patient and they come back 6 months later and you see that this score has changed significantly, that's a big deal. And it'd be important to know in what areas. And even in the Honan Yar, if someone's having significant changes in their motor skills, they're most likely going to have changes in other areas too.
Yeah.
Okay, so that just gives you a little bit of an idea. The UPDRS is very, very thorough.
Yes. Yeah, okay. I was really interested in the Honan Yar. It had like, I guess, 6 or 7 levels, but it was like the last three that was like mild, moderate, and then severe. Like severe is like bedridden. But level 3, I think, was like still mostly independent. And then it just like escalated.
Yeah, big jump.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So again, I put this on there mostly because I think it's just helpful to know what type of scales other professionals are using and keep your eye out for them in reports. And then other factors, of course, that impact the timeline choice. The person's access to and or participation in a support system. So do they have a group to follow up with? Are they going to initiate with that group? Do they have family members? Do they have transportation issues? You know, when I was in DC, transportation issues were and access to place to getting anywhere was a big issue for a lot of my patients. And then, of course, cognitive independence. So all of those things will affect when you follow up or when you suggest that they follow up with somebody. And again, including their care partner in this and saying, hey, if you're wondering, you know, what next steps are, get them involved in a support group or get them involved in a local, Parkinson's Tai Chi group. But also in about 3 months, it might be helpful for you to just go through a checklist and say, have there been changes in their cognition? Have there been changes in their swallowing? So on and so forth. And I have a resource for your care partners in just a moment to do that very thing.
Awesome.
Okay, so this is the final bit. These are the tools. So Davis Finney Foundation for Parkinson's, this is a jewel of a site. They have so many fantastic resources for people with Parkinson's. The one that I'm gonna mention, the few that I'm gonna mention, you go to their top bar across the top of their website, and they have downloadable worksheets. And this is for things like self-assessments, notes to take to your doctor's office, sexual health checklists, swallowing checklists. I mean, everything you could think of. They've got diagrams of the body and, you know, show me where the pain is. Like, they have everything that you could possibly think of. So Davis Finney Foundation for Parkinson's is a great resource to provide for patients for checklists of various kinds and note-taking and medication management. And then I have several things from Parkinson's Foundation, that movement disorder specialist finder that I mentioned earlier. There's several of these out there. I find theirs to be pretty consistently accurate, at least for my region. And then Parkinson's Foundation also has a lot of free PDFs that are really nice and fancy looking that you can hand out that provide information on topics like Parkinson's and medication or caring and coping or speech and swallowing is one. And these are completely free. You can print them or you can have them mailed to somebody. And I think that that's really helpful whenever you're educating family members on what's going on. Or if you're doing in-services even, that's a good thing for in-services. And then the Parkinson's Foundation has a helpline. So you can actually speak with an RN at that number that I've listed, and they will help you with any number of things. I've called in to figure out what's going on. They'll tell you who in your area, movement disorder specialists in your area, hospitals that are known to treat people with Parkinson's, which is a big deal. They will send you a hospital care kit so that when you go to the hospital, you have everything that you need when you have Parkinson's. That's a big deal, right? You don't want to go to the hospital and be treated by a doctor that doesn't know you and kind of get your system got all out of whack. So they have a care kit that you can take with you. The RNs can give you all sorts of information. So that's a good number to pass along. And then APDA, American Parkinson Disease Association, along with many other places, they have a free webinar series. It's very friendly to people with Parkinson's and their care partners. They talk about topics like dyskinesia management, medication management, new therapies in Parkinson's. So the tools are endless. These are just some of the ones I wanted to share today. And then patients who want to be involved in research. The university hospitals, if you have any university hospitals, typically do have research going on, and that's a great place to look. I learned about this first bullet point through the Speech Uncensored podcast and was so excited about it. So Google has a project called Euphonia, where they're basically voice banking voices that are speech patterns from people who don't have typical speech patterns to use on smart devices. Basically, if you don't talk like a robot or know how to talk like a robot to your smartphone or to Siri or Alexa, it may not understand what you're saying. And so someone with cerebral palsy or some sort of dysarthria or Parkinson's or whatever can participate in this project to increase the likelihood that these smart devices will understand what they are saying. Did I say that?
Yeah, so they're using machine learning to teach like a Siri or an Alexa to recognize voice input. So if you had your house system set up to turn on lights or something with voice activation, it would still recognize dysarthric speech. So they just need enough samples essentially to train the machines to recognize that as a pattern. They have a lot of information up that describes it much better than that. And also, like, I interviewed the Google lead project and the SLP, one of the SLPs involved in that project on the podcast. And it's just like, just really exciting what they're doing.
Yeah, very interesting. So then there's the Michael J. Fox Foundation. They have a Fox Trial Finder if they want to actually participate in trials. And there's also Fox Insight, which if you're not wanting to participate in studies or maybe aren't a good candidate for the studies, you can participate in self-reported data on your sort of everyday life with Parkinson's to help research data pools. Most everything here, tools for clinicians, I've already told you about. So I've put on the LSVT and Parkinson Voice Project websites. And that's where people, if they're really bent on finding someone who's certified in one of those things, they can find them through those websites. You can become certified through those websites. I didn't mention this earlier, but if you're looking for good cognitive and motor speech activities, I like to go to Honeycomb Speech Therapy and Therapy Insights. They have beautiful and affordable options to use evidence-based and functional activities for cognition and motor speech and other things too. Mm-hmm.
I might piggyback off that. I hope I get the name right. It's like functional cognitive retraining stimuli or something like that. It's actually on the teachers pay teachers website, which is traditionally used by our school-based SLPs. But this is made for adults by an SLP who works in skilled nursing facilities and hospitals. That really targets those functional needs for looking at memory and executive functioning and visuospatial skills. So there's like errand planning and map planning. There's medication, like check the pill box for errors, and it increases in complexity level. So I really like that one as well.
Yeah, okay, that's a good one.
It's also super affordable. It's like $2.50.
Lovely.
I love that.
I've listed those two podcasts that I referenced about the swallowing with Parkinson's and the swallowing exercises. And then if you're needing some, I haven't actually watched the CEU, but through Therapy Insights, there was a CEU about building habits and promoting healthy behaviors. And I thought that that was particularly pertinent and could be a really cool CEU if you're looking to work on your persuasion skills. And then the chart that compares Lewy body dementia and PDD is there. And then my website's there if you think that my website would be helpful for a care partner or for you or for somebody with Parkinson's, please feel free to give that to them for them to check out and cruise around the site. Woo, okay, and references. So, do we have questions?
We do.
Okay.
So we were wondering if you could provide some more examples of education and or treatment that you provide to support executive functioning in PD patients.
Yeah, absolutely. So read me the first part one more time. I want to make sure I'm answering the question directly.
Examples of education or treatment to target executive functioning.
Yeah. So obviously, some of this depends on which executive functions I'm working on. I really like to use the example when I'm educating about executive functions, especially like planning or task switching, that whenever you're having difficulty with the executive functions, it's kind of like your, you know, breaker system. And I talk to them about when you have too many plugs in that then none of it works. And so being able to say, okay, really, maybe you used to be, I'm mixing metaphors here, but you used to be able to, you know, spin 6 plates at a time and it wasn't a big deal, but now maybe you really can only do 2 or 3. And part of what we're gonna do is figure out where your threshold is so that you can confidently walk into your job or your scheduling your family's activities or meal planning and say, really, I can only have this many things going on if I'm going to be effective and successful in completing this task. And so I use a lot of metaphors about not overloading the system, whatever that system, you know, looks like and whatever tasks that may look like. I really like to ask them, what do you have going on this week? Like, what's your schedule this week? And whatever they tell me, I'll say, great, we're going to focus on some of those activities. We do a little bit of role playing. Okay, what's that going to look like when you're trying to figure out how to meal plan for this week? What are some of the distractions that you may have to weed out? We do a little bit of the, I'm going to forget the model, what it's called, but it's plan.
Goal, plan, do, review.
There it is. You knew. It's been a while since I've used that one, but I used to use that quite a bit. And I think it can be a helpful guide to say, great, well, you know, our goal is for you to menu plan, even though, you know, you've got all these other distractions going on. What can you do? We can turn the TV off. Okay, well, let's practice that. I'll put on some background noise and I want you to see what you could do to weed it out. How low do you have to turn the volume to be able to complete this task? And really have them practice right there in the room. And I think it's helpful to ask them what's going on so that they can practice whatever's coming up. I also ask about appointments because I can't tell you how many times I role play as a physician, right? So I say, oh, great, you're going to see your ENT or your gastroenterologist or your cardiologist, and let's start role playing now. You know, what does it look like for you to be put on the spot and need to plan out what you're about to say? And you know, what does it look for you to plan on how to get there on time? Time management's a big one, right? And figuring out how to kind of calculate how to get to the appointments on time. So those are some of the things that I do. I like to get right up in their business and what they're doing that, like those next few days, so that they can put it into practice.
Yes, I think that's so important because then they can immediately see the effects and they see the application of why they're coming to see us, how this impacts their daily life.
Right.
That was something I struggled with early in my career because I was like that workbook dependent clinician that wasn't making those connections between they're coming because they're having a problem in their home environment.
Right.
That's what we need to be focused on and working on and problem solving in this session as best we're able to.
Yes.
I had another kind of quick one. You did kind of answer it when you were talking about the tools for patients.
Yes.
But it was finding a neurologist near a patient that specializes in Parkinson's or has a movement disorders clinic. But I feel like you were talking about that one in the realm of like calling that hotline to talk to a nurse. Was that it?
Or so there is a, if you go to Parkinson's Foundation or put in just Google movement disorder specialist finder, Parkinson's Foundation has one and they'll put in their zip code and it will show anyone within whatever mile radius they've selected, 25, 10 miles, 25 miles, 50 miles. If that is not something they're cognitively able to do, they can call that line.
Okay. All right. Because I'm nosy and I'm a visual learner. Would you switch your screen to the like a webpage and like literally do that, like Google that, click it, like.
Absolutely.
Guide me, girl, guide me.
Yep, you got it.
Thanks.
Okay, let's see here. So Michael J. Fox also has one. I like the one on Parkinson's. That's why you had me do it, huh?
Yeah, I'm just kind of curious, like what's going to come up?
Yes. I'm curious. See, look, that's my local thing. See, you're right. It doesn't just come up perfectly. So let me find it here.
Search our resource map. Wow, they really need to like make that a little more.
I know, it needs to be like on the front page, huh?
Yeah.
So expert PD centers, that's not what I want. Let's see. I'm gonna see if it'll enter and put my, definitely don't wanna go more than 10 miles.
I was gonna say, didn't you say you live rural now? You might wanna expand that scope.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point. Actually, I think that's what happened the other day too. Yes, there we go. Okay. So.
Yeah, you have to go all the way to Washington, DC, which is, what's the drive time?
About an hour.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, about an hour.
Not terrible, but
no, not terrible at all. And this, so I what I will do is I need to find, you know, I'm trying to think if this is even the one that I would suggest going to now because I feel like it's really hard to find. But again, you can give a call and they can also tell you who to look for. I like this because you can see the names.
Yeah. And it's got links to websites when they maybe have a website, like that's handy.
Yeah.
And phone numbers. So you can just call up the facility and ask, are you taking new patients or XYZ?
Right. And the Parkinson's Foundation only lists, it says here, denotes a Parkinson's Foundation Center of Excellence. So they had to meet certain criteria if they have this little P next to it.
Okay. All right. Well, very cool, Hannah. If there aren't any more questions from our attendees, then we're at time. That was wonderful. Hannah, I've really, really enjoyed how you've approached this topic and given us tools, not only to help us treat our patients better, but to give them tools as well and their caregiver tools. So I think that's really helpful. And I like how you've highlighted I'm gonna do like a terrible job of describing it, but connecting with doctors and plugging them in, the patient, where they need to go if they're not already being seen by a specialist, or maybe they need a GI referral or something like that. Like, that's really awesome. And Mary would like to say thank you for sharing your experience and your knowledge. So
absolutely, you're very welcome. I'm always happy to talk about Parkinson's. So thanks everybody for being here. It was a total enjoyment on my part. And please feel free, if you have any follow-up questions, you can send me a message. I'm completely open, and my information, contact information, it's all over the place, but you can also go to my website and contact me that way if you'd like to.
All right. Well, that's everything from us. So have a good night, everyone. Thanks for coming.
Good night.
Thanks for listening to another edition of the Speech Uncensored podcast. Show notes with links to resources mentioned in the episode are posted on speechuncensored.com. I'd love for you to subscribe to the podcast and leave a thoughtful review on Apple Podcasts. And finally, I'd like to leave you with my wish for you to nourish your mind so that your practice can flourish.